In China, a promotion and a mystery. There is a new foreign minister, the country's top diplomat. Wang Yi is his name. It is not his first time as foreign minister. The real story, though, is about whom he replaced, a rising star named Qin Gang, a man who disappeared from public view about a month ago. His tenure only lasted about 6 months. So what's going on? Jeff Wasserstrom is a professor of Chinese history at the University of California, Irvine. What do we know, Jeff, about why Qin Gang was let go?
I think the main thing we know, or that's important to know, is how little we know. I've been reading up on, you know, people who literally spend their time focusing on elite politics, and they're baffled by sort of untangling it or saying different kinds of explanations. The word opaque keeps being brought up to describe the decision-making process within the People's Republic of China. And I think that's really the key thing. The key takeaway is it's amazing that something involving somebody so important, as some people describe me, he was the face of the party state to the outside world, can disappear without any kind of explanation except that this happened. So it is a kind of full disappearance.
Yes. So before we lose too much information, tell us more about Qin Gang. I know he had been a real favorite of President Xi Jinping. What other positions had he held? And what was the excitement about this rising star in the party?
So the interesting thing about him was he was a combination of being an intense nationalist. You can't be part of the current iteration of the Chinese Communist Party leadership without being intensely nationalistic. But he also had a kind of cosmopolitan side to him, at least in this kind of self-presentation. He was more kind of accessible than some of the other people within leadership. When he was in the United States as representative to the U.S., he was a basketball fan. When he was in England, he was public about being an Arsenal supporter. There was a way in which he was a kind of easier to take home to the family version of a hawkish, in some ways, strong defender of the official lines. So in a way, he represented, say, the side of Xi Jinping that we used to see more of when he would show up at Davos and speak the kind of language of globalization, even while being a hardline ruler at home.
Yeah, so kind of a warm and fuzzy version. What were his accomplishments in the half year that he served as foreign minister?
Well, I mean, this is so much Xi Jinping's government that it really, the accomplishments are about presenting Xi's vision to the world rather than putting your own stamp on it. And this is why it's interesting, because he was seen as close to Xi Jinping. Everybody has to be in line with Xi Jinping, but not all are seen as close to him. So the fact that he was a protege of Xi was probably the most interesting thing about him, which seemed to be something that would have protected him. And that's what makes his demotion and the return to power of his predecessor so curious.
Again, if we look for answers within recent events, tension over Taiwan and Hong Kong, notably, human rights generally, I mean, did Qin Gang ever step out of the official line?
Not that we know of. I mean, this is, again, we don't know what kind of discussions there are behind closed doors. We used to have a sense of there being sort of different factions. This may be a play between different kinds of factions, but we just don't have enough information at this point coming out. It's always been a black box to some extent. And we've always, when we speculated about things, gotten some things wrong. But now, you know, if black boxes can get blacker than ever, this one is.
What does this abrupt dumping of Qin Gang, Jeff, say about power in China these days?
Well, it says something that we knew already, that power is really tightly concentrated in Xi Jinping's hands, and we really don't know much about how he makes decisions. But it also does show that there needed to be a formal process gone through, a special assembly called of other leaders to announce this change. So it isn't as though Xi Jinping is operating completely separate from a party state organization. He's part of that. He's just at the head of it. But on the other hand, it shows again how much we don't know. We don't know who's close to him. We thought that Qin Gang was, and if even he isn't safe, and if even with him, they can't come up with a story immediately to explain why he's being removed, it just plays again to that sense of opaqueness, of a black box that's blacker than ever.
I mean, Jeff, you follow what's going on in China. How long have you known that Qin Gang had been missing?
Oh, I knew that. I mean, there had been reports of him simply not having appeared for a while, but that periodically happens. And it happened even with Xi Jinping at one point. And there are then rumors that circulate that the person is out of favor. And then often they just reappear. So it was known that he was out of the public eye and that there were various rumors about an affair, about various things that could have explained it. But we didn't know until the announcement that that meant he was actually going to be demoted. There are other figures who disappear, and we kind of know a reason. Disappearing is a key part of Chinese politics. We see dissident figures disappear in differing ways. We've seen in Hong Kong, the place that I'm following most closely, activists have been disappearing quite regularly. But with elite figures, sometimes they disappear briefly and then reappear, and it's as if nothing had happened. And that doesn't happen with these other kinds of disappearances.
The new foreign minister is Wang Yi. Who is he, Jeff?
Well, he's somebody who's reappeared, to play on this idea. The main thing to know about him is that he was in this position for more than a decade before Qin Gang. So it's really, if you have a regime that prizes stability above all else, if you're going to make a change, bringing back somebody who formerly held that role and has never stopped being part of the kind of ruling elite leadership group, that's the way you can have a change without having much of a change. So I can see why that was an attraction. He may be just a placeholder figure until somebody else is groomed for the job or placed in the job, or he may just continue it.
Jeff Wasserstrom is a professor of Chinese history at the University of California, Irvine. Thank you very much, Jeff. Really appreciate it.
It was my pleasure.
President Xi will be getting a high-level visitor this fall, Russian President Vladimir Putin. The Kremlin announced today that Putin will head to China in October when China hosts the One Belt, One Road Forum about its global infrastructure projects. More recently, Putin backed out of attending a summit in South Africa when that visit became ensnared by the possibility that Putin could be arrested for war crimes while there. A few months ago, marine scientists made an accidental discovery, ancient and thriving coral reefs off the coast of the Galapagos.
These areas are beautiful, they're diverse, and they are going to be impacted by climate change.
So now scientists are racing to figure out how to protect them and discover why those corals are still doing so well when many are not. Still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. You remember the bird flu caused by the virus known as H5N1? Last year, it drove egg prices through the roof when poultry farms in the U.S. got hit. It was part of an outbreak that began in Europe in 2021 and still continues to spread worldwide. William Schaffner is a professor of medicine at Vanderbilt University Medical Center. He studies infectious diseases. Professor Schaffner, new research out of Australia has been tracking the advance of avian flu. What more is being learned at this point?
Well, Marco, avian flu is getting to parts of the world, such as South America, where it hasn't been before, and it's causing a substantial die-off of many wild birds, particularly seabirds. And wherever it goes, this virus is spreading to domestic poultry also.
Just how does avian flu spread?
The principal way it spreads is through migratory birds. These birds, of course, can travel thousands of miles, and they can carry this virus with them. And when they settle down in order to get food and water, they often intermingle with poultry flocks, and then they can spread the virus to the local poultry flocks as they wend their way around the world on their migratory patterns.
And what is the latest estimate of how many birds have been killed by this avian flu, and are all species vulnerable?
Well, particularly seabirds, but the numbers are now estimated to be actually in the millions of birds. It's hard to track, as you can imagine, but the bird ecologists are out there trying to get an estimate of this, and they're very concerned that in at least some parts of the world, the death rate in the wild population of certain species might be such that it will take a long time for these birds to reconstitute themselves in various geographic areas.
So just to clarify, is this the same virus that spread through poultry farms in the U.S. last year? Like, is H5N1 still a problem in the U.S.?
It appears to be the same virus. we haven't been having the same problem in the U.S. right at this time, because many of the birds now appear to have developed some immunity, those survivors.
So as this disease spreads, how likely is it that more bird populations will gain that immunity?
As with humans, when you get a pandemic flu that goes around the world, it causes a lot of devastation the first time around, but also creates a level of population immunity such that the population, in this case birds now, can resist the infection as it comes around during its second season.
Well, the H5N1 virus has been rampant now for at least 3 years. What are your biggest concerns about it today, Professor?
Aside from the ecological concerns, I'm also concerned about the impact on inexpensive protein for many parts of the world, particularly the developing world. Now, fortunately, this virus has not, and I emphasize not, picked up the genetic capacity to spread readily among humans. I think the risk to the human population is low at the moment, but the world's virology community is watching this very, very carefully.
William Schaffner is a professor of medicine at Vanderbilt University Medical Center, updating us on the spread of the H5N1 virus, the avian flu, which is expected to reach every corner of the planet. Professor, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
The war in Sudan has escalated into what some are calling a civil war. In the past few weeks, entire villages have been burned to the ground in the western Darfur region. Using satellite photos and old-fashioned sleuthing, a private group is now working with the State Department to try to prevent a repeat of the genocide there 20 years ago. Dina Temple-Raston, host of the podcast Click Here, takes us inside the group's work.
Back in 2005, Nathaniel Raymond was working for Oxfam, a charity that focuses on global poverty, and he found himself posted in Biloxi, Mississippi, helping survivors of Hurricane Katrina. And that's where he noticed something troubling.
We were on the peninsula in a primarily African-American community around the Division Street Baptist Church. And I observed that there was almost no federal or state assistance making it onto the peninsula. But meanwhile, over on the less affected, primarily white side of town, there was a significant amount of aid.
There were probably lots of reasons why this was, but the one that he started to zoom in on was something he calls digital visibility.
Basically, the white population was more visible to responders. They had cell phones, they had cars where they could charge those cell phones, and that there were less barriers for that population to be connected than the African-American population that had few cell phones.
Nathaniel started thinking there has to be a different way to use technology to distribute aid in a way where it went to the neediest, not just the most visible. He thought a good place to start was with this then-nascent program called Google Earth. Nathaniel wrote a whole paper laying out his idea, and he sent it to Google. And then, well, crickets. Nothing. Not until 5 years later, in 2010, when sort of out of the blue, the memo resurfaced in the most unexpected way. His nerdy idea had caught the attention of one of the most famous actors on the planet.
Please state your name for the record.
Daniel Ocean.
You have been implicated. George Clooney. His people contacted Nathaniel to say, "We read your paper. We want to talk. We have an idea of how we might make this work."
George Clooney and a large part of the cast of Ocean's 11, Matt Damon, Don Cheadle, Brad Pitt, want you to build what was in that memo.
George Clooney had recently launched an NGO focused on Sudan, specifically Darfur. And he'd had an epiphany of his own, and it had to do with the 1994 genocide in Rwanda.
Now the human disaster in Rwanda has also reached the shores of Africa's Great Lake. Every day, thousands of bodies are floating down the Kagera River.
The violence there ended after 100 days because the world watched it happen. There were news crews and wrenching photographs in the newspapers. And that visibly forced world leaders to step in. And the perpetrators had to stop the violence. Clooney's NGO wanted to take the lessons of Rwanda and apply them to Sudan. In Sudan, the places where the massacres were occurring were just too remote. But satellites could cover a lot of ground in one picture. And they wanted Nathaniel to take his favorite technology, satellites, and operationalize the idea he'd sent in that memo to Google so many years before. And when George Clooney asks you to build something to save the people of Darfur, well, you build it. Nathaniel and his team went to work trying to figure out not just how to use satellites to catch perpetrators in the act, but maybe even prevent their attacks from happening in the first place.
The theory was that we could not only document attacks against civilians in near real time, but we could see when and where the Sudan Armed Forces or other actors might attack civilian communities ahead of time.
Not on our watch, George Clooney's group gave Nathaniel Raymond the seed money he needed to create something he called the Satellite Sentinel Project. They would find a satellite, point it in the direction of a conflict, and then marry the images from space with intelligence gathered on the ground. They'd create a kind of open-source intelligence with a low-orbit twist. And while that kind of thing is more common now, it was just getting its start back then. But of course, this isn't cheap. Back then, a single satellite image cost thousands of dollars. So Nathaniel got a satellite company called Digital Globe to agree to donate images and train his team on how to analyze them. And the images started to pour in. They'd get a new one every 24 to 36 hours, and then they'd use them to try to connect the dots.
It was done entirely manually, to the point where we even used string markers on a laminated map in rulers to plot flight directions of bombers.
Did it look like something out of A Beautiful Mind?
It looked like something out of a Wes Anderson movie. You know, it looked like a kid had opened up their pencil case and basically had started sketching on a map and then using string to do radial plotting of operational ranges of Antonovs and Sukhoi ground strike fighters and MiGs.
And the more they did this work, the more they learned, sometimes the hard way.
And there was this one moment early on in Sudan where we thought we saw this massive amount of dismounted infantry moving through a mountain pass towards a village. And a colleague of ours, a satellite imagery company, we bring in to have a second opinion. He's like, "Gentlemen, you just got yourself a herd of cows." They were longhorn cattle.
The lesson? Your pictures are only as good as your analysis and the intelligence that told you where to focus.
Everyone focuses on the satellites, but at the end of the day, what we do is really at the intersection of technology and anthropology. Understanding how populations behave is critical to being able to detect patterns of certain groups and ways in which those patterns are changing.
And even with all that, sometimes knowing where to point your satellite isn't enough, because it turns out sophisticated technologies buzzing around in space fall prey to something we're also at the mercy of here on Earth, the weather. Consider the time that Nathaniel and his team had been watching tensions mount in southern Sudan. To provide a little context first, the government had been targeting local tribes there.
And one day, there's an announcement made. Everyone in the city is supposed to gather at a soccer stadium.
This is Caitlin Howarth, director of operations for Nathaniel's lab.
The folks in the city essentially say, absolutely not. We have seen this movie. We don't gather at the soccer stadium. We're going to get the heck out of here.
So instead of going to the soccer stadium where they were sure bad things would happen, the local residents fled to a UN peacekeeping base north of the city. Thousands of people gathered there, outside the locked gates. Nathaniel and the team could see it, right there on their screens. And then they noticed something more sinister. Militias were starting to move in on the crowds.
They'd used the UN mission as a honey trap, knowing that the announcement telling everybody to go to the soccer stadium would draw the city's population to the UN mission. Those people were exactly where the murderers intended for them to be. It was a kill box.
Nathaniel's team was monitoring all of this, and now that violence appeared imminent, they wanted to make sure their satellites documented it, to hold people accountable. So they pointed their camera in the sky at the camp, and then
the clouds came in.
And the satellites just clicked off. They went dark.
And when clouds come in, satellites have a masking alg where they will shut off to conserve memory space if the cloud content is too high.
They felt helpless. Local sources on the ground told them what was happening that they couldn't see.
A individual who our colleagues at Enough had named Job, he would come out at night and there would be dogs, he said, carrying around body parts of his neighbors.
On the ground, Job saw piles of bodies and mass graves. While the eyewitness accounts were detailed and incriminating, the team knew that they needed more than that to hold the perpetrators to account. They wanted a photograph of the graves themselves.
And that's when we had an amazing technological breakthrough.
Well, technology and good old-fashioned mapping skills. They heard reports that the militia had dug mass graves to the south of a nearby school, but they didn't know exactly where to look. So they went retro. They took out a piece of paper, drew an alphanumeric grade on top of the latest picture they had of the area, and then sent it to their contact on the ground, this guy named Job. Job looked at this grid and then started giving additional coordinates.
He said, the school is by B6. And then we would zoom in and send another image that was closer. And then he would look at that and he would do the grid again and say it was E3 or something to that effect.
So that was a start, but still not precise enough.
And so we had to ask Job to walk toe to heel in the middle of the night from a radio tower down to the grave because we had to get the distance correct for the shot. And he did.
Job didn't have a tape measure, but he did have the next best thing, his feet. He measured the distance, heel to toe, from a radio tower they could see to the mass graves they couldn't. And then all they could do was wait. Finally, the clouds parted and the picture was snapped.
And when the shot came in, it was three soccer field-sized graves.
They got it. Evidence, proof of what happened that was admissible in a court of law. But Nathaniel and his team weren't just working to document attacks. They wanted to find ways to help prevent them, or at least dial back their brutality. So they began digging deeper into patterns that might help them predict future events. And as they cross-referenced and studied and read, they did start to see places to connect the dots, data points.
They began to tell a story. And that story allowed us to be more and more predictive as the time went on.
Like back in the spring of 2011, Nathaniel and his team had been tracking the movements of the Sudanese armed forces around the city of Abyei. It's an oil-rich, fertile area that straddles the border between North and South Sudan. And the area is crawling with militia. And the team had heard about a series of arson attacks in nearby villages.
2 to 3 weeks out, we had seen enough to know that these initial arson attacks were preface moves to a larger strike on Abyei.
Nathaniel called his bosses to say that it looked like the Sudanese forces were preparing to attack. And then a remarkable thing happened. They were able to warn people on the ground, to spread the word that it looked like the military was preparing to move in, so people knew to leave or at least prepare. On June 9th of this year, the State Department announced that they were partnering with Nathaniel's lab to monitor the war in Sudan. Here's Caitlin Howarth again.
We're in a very different position as a team this time. Working directly with the State Department means we have a level of access that we only could have imagined the last time that we did this.
Technology is important, but it isn't what it's really about. At the end of the day, it's about seeing human beings, not in new ways, but hopefully in ways that make us act different and teach us to outgrow our madness.
For the world, I'm Dina Temple-Raston.
Dina is the host of the cyber and intelligence podcast Click Here. International scientists made an unexpected discovery a few months ago: pristine coral reefs deep underwater off the Galapagos Islands. The healthy reefs were teeming with marine life. Now that discovery is leading to research that could help save deep sea corals globally from the impacts of climate change. From the Galapagos, reporter Vera Heiler has a story.
Stuart Banks was inside the submersible Alvin as it descended to the ocean floor.
But then suddenly, you know, there was this huge build-up reef that just went on and on and on.
Once the shock and awe of the discovery subsided, the scientists went to work. They used the submersible's external mechanical arms, nets, and a vacuum-like device to collect samples. It was like striking gold for Banks, a marine scientist at the Charles Darwin Foundation, and the other researchers on the Atlantis expedition.
It was a highly productive, ancient, extremely physically vulnerable, unmapped habitat.
A few months later, Banks takes me to a lab room at the Darwin Foundation on Santa Cruz Island in the Galapagos.
But this is a fossil coral. So this is kind of, it looks a bit grotty, but that's kind of what fossil coral looks like on the bottom of the ocean.
Corals are laid out on the counter, spiny fossils in plastic bags, live specimens, some purple and orange floating in alcohol in jars, all from those coral reefs that Banks and his colleagues discovered. The importance of the discovery lies with its location in the deep sea, about 1,600 feet below the surface. These cold water corals support important marine ecosystems, and they're vulnerable to climate change, just as the more recognizable shallow tropical reefs that most people know.
You have huge areas of the world's oceans which are completely unmapped, which are all deeper than people can easily reach by research diving. Over 90-95% of the world's oceans.
Michelle Taylor was the other scientist aboard the submersible with Banks. She says that when the outside cameras illuminated the breathtaking view of the reefs, it was literally like shining a light on the global importance of deep sea corals.
These areas are beautiful, they're diverse, and they are going to be impacted by climate change.
Taylor studies deep sea corals with an eye toward learning how to protect them. Some of the Galapagos specimens are being shipped to her lab at the University of Essex in England.
We are going to spend time cataloging like all of the animals that we saw, the density of them, how many of them there were. And we're going to, you know, use that as a baseline.
Basically, in future dives, researchers can use that baseline to see how changes in the ocean's temperature and higher acidity caused by carbon absorption have affected the reefs. Taylor says that scientists in biogeochemistry at the University of Bristol in the UK will take a different tack, going back in time to study the gene history of coral fossils.
You can have a little look at what the chemistry of the ocean around Galapagos was like 10,000 years ago, 50,000 years ago, 100,000 years ago, from looking at coral skeletons. And we can start having an idea of just how different the environment is these corals now than it was then.
The Galapagos are an archipelago of volcanic islands. They're about 600 miles from Ecuador's mainland and sit at the intersection of several ocean currents. They famously support an unrivaled diversity of land and marine life. The islands have long been a center for naturalistic research. It was Charles Darwin's expedition here in 1835 that resulted in his seminal work on the origins of species. The discovery of the coral reef has done little to pierce the usual routines of the islands. At a dock not far from the Darwin Foundation, fishermen unload their daily catch, sea lions lounge on nearby benches, tourist boats return, laden with visitors, sated after a day of snorkeling. But scientists around the world are fascinated by the discovery. Sebastian Henniga is a leading researcher of ocean acidification and its impact on deep sea coral at the University of Edinburgh. He says deep sea corals play a big role in the ocean.
They're rainforests of the deep. They create these vast structures and they support thousands of different species. So they're really, really important in terms of the framework and the habitats they build and the other species which they support.
He says the Galapagos discovery will result in knowledge vital to the conservation of deep sea corals.
The first part in solving a problem is being aware of the existence of the ecosystem and then how that may be under threat from different things in the future.
Henninger and the other scientists all agree that more deep sea exploration is needed to fully understand the impact of climate change on cold water corals. But these expeditions are complex, expensive, and sometimes risky, as was shown recently by the implosion of a submersible on a private expedition to the Titanic wreck. Daniel Fornari is a marine geologist at Woods Hole Oceanographic Institute on Cape Cod, which operates the Alvin submersible. Fornari was the co-leader of the Atlantis expedition. He says the discovery of the Galapagos reefs has advanced research tremendously.
The fact that we discovered it and mapped it reasonably well so that we can go back and do more work on it is huge from the point of view of sort of scientific productivity and the ability to not have to wait years and years to write yet another proposal and get yet another ship.
Banks, the Darwin Foundation scientist, is organizing another expedition off Galapagos for this fall. He and the other scientists are pretty sure there are more reefs down there that are yet to be discovered. That would lead to more research that will ultimately protect these rainforests of the deep ocean. For The World, I'm Vera Haller, Santa Cruz Island, Galapagos, Ecuador.
Vera reported the story with Gisele Regatao. In Texas, advocates for migrants attempting to cross the Rio Grande are concerned about a new water barrier. They're worried it will result in people drowning. Weighted buoys and netting are the focus of a lawsuit the Justice Department filed yesterday against the state of Texas. Much farther west in San Diego, there's a different kind of hazard facing migrants trying to cross the border illegally. Injuries when people fall from the border wall itself.
They attempt to scale down these beams and they end up falling and hurting their ankles, their spinal injuries, brain injuries, whatever it may be, unfortunately.
That's neurosurgeon Dr. Alexander Tenorio, who says emergency departments in San Diego hospitals are overwhelmed with people injured in these kinds of falls. Join us tomorrow on the show when we'll look at the impacts of increasing the height of the border wall. The World comes to you each weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio at GBH in Boston and the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. Find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Marco Werman. Be safe. Stay strong. We'll see you right back here tomorrow.